Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the December 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. Hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article titled, An American Tale. When a Japanese family was sent to an internment camp in 1942, one neighbor quietly risked everything to look after their farm and their future. By Jake Whitney. On the morning of May 29, 1942, Mary Tsukamoto awoke to find her mattress on the floor. Glancing around the bedroom that she shared with her husband, Al, it took her a moment to get her bearings. Today was the day she and her family would lose their freedom. Their bed frame, along with the rest of their furniture, was in storage. "We had broken no law, committed no criminal act," she later wrote, "but on this day we were to leave our homes. No one knew where we were to go, nor for how long we would be gone. We were labeled as criminals because our faces were Japanese." Al and Mary's daughter, Marielle, who was 5 at the time, clearly recalls that morning. "I remember getting up early and it was cold," Marielle, now 87, said to me recently. "I was told to go get my grandmother. She was in her 60s and was in the garden crying because she believed she wouldn't come back alive." As her grandmother, Ito, cried in her rose garden, her grandfather, Kuzo, took one last look at the grapevines he had planted 20 years earlier. "It is the darkest day of our lives," he told the family. "We are about to lose our treasured liberty. Will we ever see this dear place again?" Kuzo Tsukamoto had left Hiroshima around 1885 when he was 17. After laboring in the cane fields of Hawaii, fishing for salmon in Canada, and repairing railroad tracks in the northwestern United States, he settled in Florin, an agricultural community 9 miles south of Sacramento. Japanese immigrants there had innovated a technique for planting strawberries between rows of grapevines that proved to alter the economic history of the town, according to the Florin Historical Society. Soon, Florin was shipping 250 train cars of strawberries per season and calling itself the strawberry capital of the world. Kuzo's wife, Ito, joined him in Florin in 1902, and they had 4 children, Margaret, Edith, Alfred, or Al, and Nami. In 1920, they moved to a 35-acre farm. In Florin, where white Americans and Japanese immigrants' families lived and worked side by side, racism was always present. An alien land law prohibited Japanese immigrants from becoming citizens and owning land, so first-generation immigrants, known by the Japanese word isai, typically had to wait until they had children, nisai, the second generation, before they could buy land. They either bought land under their children's names or waited for their children to grow old enough to buy it themselves. And while some whites were grateful to Japanese farmers for driving the town's economic boom, others resented their success. When the Japanese were scarce and we were their customers, they were our friends, Al Tsukamoto, then 80, recalled in a 1992 interview for the Japanese American Citizens League, or JACL. But as the Japanese population grew and built their own stores and stopped patronizing white-owned stores, they didn't like us. The bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, brought that resentment out into the open. now disguised as patriotism. Immediately after the attack, the FBI arrested more than 1,200 Japanese community leaders on the West Coast, identifying them from a list of, quote, suspect enemy aliens, compiled using U.S. Census information. In her 1988 book, We the People, The Story of Internment in America, co-written by Elizabeth Pinkerton, Mary describes how agents had suddenly appeared at people's doors and taken them away. The older Isai were the most suspected. One of the Tsukamoto's Isai neighbors, who was recovering from a stroke, had difficulty speaking. After agents interrogated him, he was so afraid he had mistakenly implicated others that he hanged himself. Politicians exploited the fury against Japan to rally voters, and newspapers used it to sell papers. An op-ed by sports columnist Henry McLemore in January 1942 was representative. It read, in part, quote, I am for immediate removal of every Japanese on the West Coast to a point deep in the interior. Let him be pinched, hurt, hungry, and dead up against it. I hate the Japanese, and that goes for all of them. End quote. Cartoonists, meanwhile, portrayed Japanese people as plotting, buck-toothed buffoons. Theodore Geisel, the editorial cartoonist for PM, a liberal magazine in New York, drew a cartoon showing squinty-eyed Japanese lining up along the West Coast to be given dynamite. The caption read, Waiting for the signal from home. The cartoonist, better known by his pen name Dr. Seuss, never formally apologized for his racist cartoons. Arguably, the most damaging newspaper article was by Walter Lippmann, the widely read liberal columnist. In February 1942, after a dinner with Earl Warren, the pro-internment California Attorney General, Lippmann wrote that the Pacific Coast was in imminent danger of an attack from within and from without. He cited as evidence the fact that there was no evidence. In a case where an enemy alien hasn't committed any sabotage, he wrote, it is a sign that the blow is well organized and that it is held back until it can be struck with maximum effect. The column ran in more than 250 newspapers, and the next day every member of Congress from West Coast states signed a letter to President Franklin D. Roosevelt recommending immediate evacuation of all persons of Japanese lineage. Shortly thereafterwards, the president signed Executive Order 9066, which permitted the U.S. military to remove citizens from designated zones. This allowed the U.S. military to relocate anyone of Japanese descent living in California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Alaska, and Hawaii, to one of 10 barbed wire-encircled camps. These camps were situated in some of the most inhospitable land in the country, such as the sun-baked Arizona desert and the fetid swampland of Arkansas. The Tsukamotos learned that they would still be required to pay the mortgage and taxes on their farm during incarceration. If they didn't, California law permitted banks and the state to take over abandoned properties. Al and Mary considered reaching out to the Florin Fruit Growers Association, or FFGA, the local farmers' cooperative, for help. But Al came to suspect that the association, whose leadership was dominated by white farmers, was not making deals in the best interests of Japanese-American families. Instead, the Tsukamotos turned to a state agricultural inspector named Bob Fletcher, who certified fruit and produce in California and Arizona. A taciturn man, Fletcher had nevertheless become friendly with the Tsukamotos in the course of his work. Al proposed an arrangement. If Fletcher could tend their farm and pay their bills, he could keep the profits. And not only the Tsukamotos, Al asked Fletcher if he would also work the farms of two other Japanese families, the Okamotos and the Nitas, and pay their bills as well. This would mean tending 90 acres of Tokay grapes for an unknown duration of time. Fletcher, who had no experience raising grapes, said he needed to think about it. Within a week, he gave his answer. He would help, and because he would have to quit his job to handle the work, he would need to keep some profits, he said. But he refused to take them all, insisting they split them, half for himself and half for the families. As the Tsukamoto family prepared to be taken away, a number of other wonderful Caucasian friends lent support, Mary wrote. One, Mary McComber, brought them casseroles and cakes. The town's former high school principal, Roy Learned, offered to store their possessions. "Did we ever consider not obeying the order?" Mary asked in her 1988 book. "Never. It was our duty, and we had better be there on time." She added, "How we ached to prove our loyalty to the only country we had ever known." Her daughter, Muriel, told me recently that the widespread compliance with relocation was cultural, but also practical. You had elderly parents who didn't speak much English, couldn't write, and didn't have citizenship. My dad did all the banking and the business. My grandfather couldn't do that. So if the adults fought back and got themselves arrested, what would happen to the rest of the family? On May 29, 1942, the Tsukamotos made sure to be at the Elk Grove train station by 9 a.m., as they had been instructed. Al's other sisters would also be on the train with their families, along with Mary's parents, Taro and Carney, and Mary's siblings, Jean, Julia, Ruth, Isabel, and George. A small group of white friends braved criticism to see them off, Mary wrote, bringing them sandwiches and cookies for the trip. George and Margaret Feel took them to the station, while Bob Fletcher drove away their belongings. "We were all on the train crying," Muriel recalled. "We were hungry, we were hot, we wanted to go home. About half of us were children. Were we going to get killed? Were we going to be used as slaves? Nobody knew anything." If they did manage to make it through whatever came next, all their hopes for the future rested on one man, Bob Fletcher. When Robert Emmett Fletcher, Jr. died in 2013, obituaries saluted his courage, but I was surprised that his story was not more widely known. So I set out to learn more about him. I found his granddaughter, Jill Stowers, who was living in Idaho, and who had unearthed a journal, never before published, in which Fletcher wrote about the major events of his life. Between the journal and other new discoveries, I realized there was more of Fletcher's story to tell. As soon as the Japanese families were moved to the camps, Fletcher took over their farms, and, per his agreement, began to save money for them. In the process, he angered community members who supported internment. At one point, someone fired a shot into the Tsukamoto's barn. Interviewed years later about why he agreed to help, Fletcher was characteristically humble. "I don't think I did anything," he told Elizabeth Pinkerton in an interview for the JACL in 1995. "It was just something that needed to be done." As to the anger he faced in the community and the shooting attempt, he added, "I was too busy to even think about it." Fletcher was born in 1911, the only child of Robert Fletcher Sr., a farmer, and Olive Fletcher, a schoolteacher. His grandparents had come to California on wagon trains in the 1850s from Pennsylvania and New York. His paternal grandfather, John Fletcher, had been one of the California 100. Californians who wanted to fight for the Union in the Civil War, and traveled to Massachusetts to form an all-California battalion. These cavalrymen participated in the Third Battle of Winchester, a key victory for the Union. Those who knew Fletcher described him essentially the same way. Lean and in 6'2", he was stoic and unwaveringly polite. Muriel said he looked like a cowboy and kind of reminded me of Gary Cooper. He was a man of high ideals who believed in hard work. Grandpa would come in from working the fields and say hello, Jill Stowers told me of childhood visits to her grandparents, and then go right back to work, and we wouldn't see him again until dinner. Stowers' father and Fletcher's son, also named Robert, born in 1946, emphasized his father's work ethic as well, but noted that his dedication kept the two of them from seeing much of each other. He was so busy, he'd come home from wherever he was working, change his clothes, go out in the fields, and either cut hay, rake hay, or bale hay. I didn't really get a chance to talk to him. I spent most of my time with my mom and grandma. As for any life lessons he learned from his father growing up, he said with a laugh, "He made me work." A Vietnam veteran, Robert Fletcher III, worked in steel production, then for a lumber company, then the postal service, before starting his own freight company in Idaho, which he ran until he retired in 2013. When I asked if growing up he was aware of what his father had done for the Japanese families, he said yes, but mainly from discussions with others. His dad didn't discuss it much until later in life. While the arrangement between Fletcher and the families was nominally a business deal, the people I spoke with insisted that, for Fletcher, it wasn't about money. He didn't want the money, just enough to cover him, his son told me. So when they came back from the camps, there was a little cash flow for those people. Stowers agreed. I just remember him always saying it was the right thing to do, the neighborly thing to do. Muriel was the most insistent. Bob knew we were just like any other Americans, she told me. He was a man of few words, but he always did what he thought was right. I also spoke with Carl and Brian Okamoto, sons of Sam Okamoto, a neighbor whose farm Fletcher also saved. Neither brother ever met Fletcher, but they heard his name many times. Fletcher was like a legend in our family, Carl said. He was the guy who preserved the property, so there was something to come back to after World War II. He added that he'd heard of a Florin man named George Carlisle, who also helped pay the bills for multiple Japanese families while they were incarcerated. This was corroborated by a JACL interview I found with Percy Nakashima, another farmer in Florin, who asked Carlisle to tend his farm and two other farms while he and his family were sent to the Manzanar camp in the California desert. That arrangement was a formal business deal, and while Carlisle does not appear to have split the profits with the families, Nokashima's gratitude is apparent on the recording. His voice breaks when he describes Carlisle as our most trusted Caucasian friend. Fletcher's journal consists of 27 pages of handwritten notes. While they are not introspective, several shine more light on how he accomplished his feat and how he felt about it. In his first few journal entries, Fletcher recalled his earliest memories, including going to town to shop with my mother in a horse and buggy, helping drive cattle with my father, and riding my horse to grammar school. In 1924, his family moved to a 20-acre farm in Brentwood, California, where his dad planted barley and almonds. Fletcher studied horticulture at the University of California, Davis, where he also ran track and played basketball. After college, he worked as the foreman of a peach ranch in Red Bluff, A couple of years later, he got the position as an agricultural inspector. In the entries titled 1942 to 1945, one wishes Fletcher had more to say about the war, his work on the farms, and what was happening in Florin. But a couple of entries are telling. In one, he notes how he got through the harvest season. "This was a very difficult time, but I was able to get people to help in the harvesting and picking of the grapes. During the harvest, we were able to get about 15 people to help. Some days we were able to get packed between 200 and 300 boxes of Tokay grapes, and later 10 tons of grapes to the winery." I discovered more unpublished information about Fletcher in a trove of audio interviews at California State University, Sacramento. The files included interviews with Japanese Americans, including a number of Florin residents, conducted for the JACL and focusing on the war years. One interview with Mary Tsukamoto from the 1990s provided evidence that Fletcher, in working the three farms, sacrificed more than had previously been known. In Mary's JACL interview, she mentioned that Fletcher had had a first wife named Clara, a fact I was able to confirm with the Sacramento County Recorder's Office. In Mary's view, that marriage had collapsed because of his long days working the three farms. Muriel told me that Clara had been helpful to their family while they were incarcerated, often sending items they could not acquire in camp. Fletcher met his second wife, Teresa Cesari, when she and her mother were hired to help work the Japanese-American farms. They tied the grapevines, and when Fletcher would pick them up in his truck, he told Pinkerton, "She always got in first and sat beside me." Bob and Teresa married in June 1945, shortly before the Tsukamoto's return. They had their only child, Robert Fletcher III, the following year. Neither Fletcher's son nor his granddaughter, Jill Stowers, was aware that he'd had an earlier marriage. While Fletcher was caring for their farms, the Tsukamotos were trying to settle into their new life. Most of the main camps were not ready right away, so their first destination was the Fresno Assembly Center, which operated between May and October 1942. It was located on sprawling fairgrounds a few miles outside the city and consisted, Mary wrote, of row after row of ugly black tar-paper-covered buildings in the barren desert, with not a single green tree to be seen. At its peak, the Fresno Center held more than 5,000 Japanese Americans, with some incarcerees kept in horse stalls. For the Tsukamotos, life in Fresno was awful. Their first shock was the armed guards. One government rationale for internment was that it was for the incarcerees' own protection. A common retort in the camps was, "So why are the guards pointing their guns at us?" There was no privacy, the barracks were cramped, and the food was often literally sickening. The bathrooms were abominable. Incarcerees had to line up at the toilets in rows, in full view of each other. The first time Mary used the bathroom, she vomited after raw sewage almost splashed on her. Meanwhile, Mary, as executive secretary of Florin's JACL, was often falsely accused of providing her own family with perks that others did not receive. This resulted in loud, ugly arguments. "The worst in us was exposed as we were forced to give up our dignity," she later wrote. Still, their lives settled into a routine. There was a newsletter, The Grapevine, that shared news from inside and outside the camp, including updates on the war. There were baseball leagues, and Al got a job as a recreation director, which paid $12 a month. Mary helped organize a summer school program for 1,200 children, and she taught public speaking to grade school kids, as well as basic English to the Isai. In fact, Mary first discovered her formidable talents as a teacher in Fresno. In October, just as the Tsukamotos were settling into Fresno, they were moved to the Jerome Relocation Center in Arkansas. Mary later recalled how during the train ride, the black porters treated her family and the other Japanese incarcerees with warmth and understanding, and seemed to have a special sensitivity to our unjust treatment. But looking out the window, she was shocked by the hovels that black Americans lived in. In her JACL interview, she added that even though the Japanese were locked in camps, they realized we were better off in a way. And with that, I am afraid we have run out of time today. The name of this article was An American Tale by Jake Whitney. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading from the December 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to thesunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then click on Podcast Demand. That will show you a list of programs available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.